considerably safer now than when I was stationed there in the early 1980s, because Mayor Rudolph Giuliani and the New York City Police Department began to target predators at every level. Once predators were removed, even those involved in quality-of-life offenses such as aggressive panhandling or graffiti, honest citizens took back the streets. I wish I could say there isn't a predator in your present or future, yet chances are there is, or will be. But with a little knowledge, you stand a better chance of identifying these dangerous personalities who callously determine our future without our consent. I say this not to scare you, but to make you aware, because they are certainly aware of you. Survival means knowing what they're like and how they behave, so we can avoid them. The Way of the Predator. Predators can be nuanced and hard to detect if you don't know what to look for. They can be intelligent, friendly, attractive, quiet, reclusive, delinquent, or any number of other characteristics. Being successful, having friends, or holding a status position doesn't preclude someone from being a predator. A lesson that Penn State faculty, athletes, alumni, and students learned from Jerry Sandusky's multiple convictions for sexually abusing children, and that Bernie Madoff's friends and colleagues learned following his colossal swindle scheme. These individuals are persistently calculating, manipulative, and aggressively predatory. When you read about someone who meticulously planned and executed a crime, who stalked and staked out his victim, who's been committing criminal acts for a long time, who traveled distances to achieve an illicit endeavor, or who's constructed elaborate Ponzi schemes, you're reading about predators. Similarly, when you hear of someone who's always in trouble with the law, is a serial sex offender, a recidivist, or someone who is scheming to cheat others of their money, you're hearing about a predator. Expect predators to frequently change jobs, change plans, fail to repay loans, ruin or end relationships, disappoint or take advantage of others, and shirk responsibilities. Expect them to break laws, betray trust, take what isn't theirs, and leave others pained, victimized, maimed, or even dead. Expect it. Don't read this chapter and think someone like this will get better or won't harm you. We know they'll do harm. What we can't predict is whom or what they'll target. Predators often have superficial knowledge of many topics, which they use to impress or ensnare their victims. They love controlling people like puppets, charming children with toys and candy, luring women online to meet, getting young girls or boys to help them, or manipulating people to part with their money. They're expert at getting others to have confidence in them, which is why we call them con men. Like the other dangerous personalities in this book, the predator's behavior exists on a continuum or spectrum. Some start and stay at the low end. They do risky things, perhaps habitually breaking rules and regulations. They may be deceitful in their dealings with others, or they may be in frequent trouble with the law for petty crimes. Then there are those who are so pathological, so off the scale, that there's nothing they won't try or do so long as it pleases them. John Edward Robinson is a Renaissance man, if you will, a true entrepreneur of predation, a convicted con man, embezzler, forger, kidnapper, and sadistic serial killer, convicted in Kansas in 2003 of 3 murders. He's considered the first serial killer to use the internet to lure his victims so he could sadomasochistically kill them. He's an example of the extreme predator, a polymath of sorts, and a truly dangerous personality. These are the extreme predators we read or hear about. But for the most part, predators go unnoticed because they're successful at what they do, or simply because they don't get reported. But no matter where they are on the continuum or scale, low end or the high end, one trait they share with us is that they can learn from their mistakes and experiences and become emboldened to do even more. A case in point is Julian, I have changed his name, whose behavior I was able to track because his mother was a friend of my family. Julian began, as far as we can tell, by taking money from his parents even before he was a teenager. In time, the amounts became larger and the thefts more frequent. His parents would confront him, he'd apologize, and he'd repeat the behavior each time slightly more proficiently. To avoid his parents' attention, he began to steal from his friends and playmates as well as from their parents. As Julian got older, he pilfered bottles of wine and vodka. Prescription medications never seemed to last, disappearing completely, and at least once were replaced by aspirin. Accusations of theft were always met with ever more clever denials. His parents admittedly ignored his acts, were too accepting of his denials, bought into his explanations, or simply didn't want to be too accusatory. By their own account, they believed he'd outgrow these behaviors. Julian got into all sorts of scrapes with the police once he learned to drive. The car repeatedly was scratched and dented. One day it came home without a fender. About an hour later, the police showed up. There had been a hit-and-run accident with injuries. Of course, Julian denied it. That would be his first felony. There would be others, but they seemed always to be pled down to misdemeanors. By age 21, Julian had mastered how to extract money from his parents' bank account using forged checks or the ATM. He continued to steal ever larger amounts, and as his parents got older, they were less challenging and, in some ways, more permissive. Or maybe they were worn out by a son who was a predator, a thief, a liar, a con man, a drug user, and a danger to them, as well as to society. The final straw came when Julian stole his father's car and sold it for parts. Just like that. That same week, he took the last money they had in the house, claiming it must have been eaten by rodents, since it was hidden in the rafters. My parents tell me that Julian's father was physically and psychologically tormented and depressed by all of this, and a few months later he died a broken man. I'm told that at the funeral Julian wanted to know if he could have his father's watch so he could pawn it, and whether there was any money left in the will. Where does this story end? Not here. Julian was able to coerce his mother to give him access to her remaining retirement account and cleaned her out. In her early 70s, she was forced to go back to work. No retirement savings and no house. That had to be foreclosed, as there had been other things that he had done. Talk about a debris field of human suffering. Julian hasn't killed anybody directly that I know of, but the suffering he's caused is significant to at least one family. He's been investigated many times, but always escapes punishment. He's changed his criminal acts over time, but the result is always the same. He charmingly lies, cheats, and steals, or lives parasitically off the hard work of others. If you run into him, he'll have a smile for you. And why not? Others have sacrificed their lives for him. Maybe you will too. So while predators may differ in scope, scale, and specifics, they all share some commonalities. They take, but don't give. They put others at risk. They are callous and contemptuous. And they lack concern for others, even loved ones. No empathy, no remorse, no conscience. Watch a video of Dennis Rader, the BTK, blind torture kill, serial killer, and listen to him talk about how he killed his victims. What you will notice is what psychologists call his flat affect. That cold, matter-of-fact quality of words and expression is seen in some predators, even when recounting their horrific crimes. Predators don't feel emotion in the normal way. They don't understand others' suffering. Empathy is beyond them. Their emotions are usually superficial or contrived and self-serving. As Julian's example shows, they can victimize people who love, protect, and give to them. Our innocence or misfortune is their opportunity. An unhappy divorcee or grieving widow is a meal ticket. A trusting or unattended child is a sex toy to be lured with food and trinkets. Tourists and immigrants are easy targets for theft or protection money. Anyone who is naive or in difficulty is wearing a "use me" sign. A natural disaster is an excuse to set up bogus donation sites. The list is endless. These personalities know right from wrong and know what evil is, but they do it anyway. Case in point, Austrian Josef Fritzl placed his 18-year-old daughter in his cellar, where he imprisoned her for 24 years, raping her more than 3,000 times, fathering 7 children, and never once taking her or the children to the doctor. He reportedly told a psychiatrist, "I simply have an evil streak." Josef Fritzl knew what he was doing was wrong, and he had more than 8,000 days to stop his evil acts. He simply chose not to. If predators feel guilty, it's transitory and non-inhibitive. It won't stop them, because they don't learn from the suffering they cause. They have no remorse. Feeling guilt requires accepting responsibility for one's actions, but predators live to take advantage, not to take responsibility, preferring to blame their upbringing, bad bosses, bad luck, pornography, or anything or anyone to get off the hook, including even the victim. Jodi Arias blamed her boyfriend for driving her to stalk him. Call him habitually, seek him out, stab him repeatedly, shoot him, and nearly cut off his head. It just couldn't be because she's an unstable, selfish predator who couldn't face abandonment. No, it had to be, as is often the case with predators, the victim's fault. Fortunately, the jury didn't buy her lies. Cold, callous, calculating, controlling. Predators are coldly indifferent. It's why we liken them to reptiles, and why so often at trial they seem impervious to emotions, in stark contrast to the grieving family of the victim. Notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas captured it this way: killing someone is just like walking outdoors. If I wanted a victim, I'd just go and get one. Only predators think this way. For them, life's a game of how much can I get away with, so they plot and deceive. In the 1970s, John Wayne Gacy was involved in community politics and dressed up as Pogo the Clown to entertain neighborhood children not far from Chicago. But he also cunningly seduced boys into his home so he could sadomasochistically kill them. 33, in fact. They'd plead for their lives, and he'd callously exterminate them. Harold Shipman, the well-loved and respected doctor in Hyde, England, mentioned earlier, hid his predation for decades, cool as a cucumber. For his own financial gain, he was callously killing those who needed his help the most. It was only when too many of his patients died that the truth came out. Otherwise, he would have kept going. His criminal activity was not affecting him in the least. In fact, he was getting almost blasé about it. Out of necessity, then, the predator lives by the calculated lie. While we use words to communicate, they use words to manipulate, compel, and connive. They know the phrases of pleasantry, persuasion, seduction, appeal, and apology, as a craftsman knows his tools, or the musician her notes. Promises to never cheat, steal, or hit again are empty. Their word is worthless. Yet so many of us, even professionals such as law enforcement officers and judges, are bamboozled by them, persuaded by social convention to give them another chance. This is one reason recidivism rates are so high. Predators lie to get out of prison, promising to behave, and then they go right back to committing crimes. Jack Henry Abbott, in prison for forgery and for stabbing a fellow inmate to death, became the darling of the writing literati when he wrote about his experiences being incarcerated. In the Belly of the Beast, Letters from Prison. He persuaded acclaimed writer Norman Mailer to argue for his early release. The parole board was convinced by Mailer's pleadings and acquiesced. 6 weeks into his parole, Abbott stabbed a man to death at a cafe because, as he later said, the man stared at him for too long. All those who had advocated for Abbott's early release were shocked that someone so masterful with words could also kill. They shouldn't have been. Words coupled with acts of kindness can be very appealing. Jerry Sandusky used this combination and an ever-ready smile to trap his victims. But when he was forcing his penis inside the anus of children, yes, that's the reality of what this venerated coach predator did to his victims, he did so with callous disregard for the sanctity of those children. Predators also know the words that intimidate. One word from notorious thugs, John Gotti or James Whitey Bulger, Jr., was enough to get people to pay them protection money or be killed. While in the FBI, I interviewed a made guy for the mob, and he related that to get protection money, they'd simply have a conversation with a store owner. Otherwise, who knows? Expensive store windows might break overnight. Such little chats aren't just the stuff of the TV show The Sopranos. They fuel a multi-million dollar extortion industry. Even from death row, Ted Bundy manipulated investigators by holding out on revealing the names of all his victims. Just hours before execution, he released the name of one more as a ploy for a reprieve. No reprieve was given. He'd toyed long enough with the justice system. The name of the victim he identified was Sue Curtis, the young woman I mentioned in the introduction who was abducted at Brigham Young University while I was on duty that tragic night. Serial killer Clifford Robert Olson, Jr. manipulated the Canadian government into paying him $10,000 per victim in return for identifying them and where he'd buried them. His wife received $100,000 as a result of his cooperation. He was gracious enough to throw in the 11th victim for free. Such a gentleman. One of the most notorious predators in history was Hermann Göring, field marshal, and the second highest-ranking member of the Nazi Party. Göring had helped to set up the Gestapo, and when he wasn't busy bombing London, he was stealing artwork and other property from Jews being sent to their deaths. After World War II ended, while he was in custody of the Allied powers and awaiting trial by the Nuremberg court for war crimes, he repeatedly manipulated his American captors. In exchange for favors, he would sign autographs or have his picture taken. Most odiously, he manipulated at least one of his American captors into retrieving from his personal luggage a vial of poison that he then used to kill himself before his sentence, death by hanging, could be carried out, thus denying the court and millions of victims due justice. But this isn't just about pulling strings or manipulating others. It is worse. For many predators, it's about the godlike ability to have power over others, which can be intoxicating. Ted Bundy talked about feeling omnipotent, being able to decide who would live or die. Israel Keyes, who hid kill kits around the country filled with weapons and supplies to facilitate his crimes, and who authorities think may have killed as many as 11 victims from Alaska to Vermont between 2001 and 2012, preferred to strangle his victims barehanded so that he could enjoy watching them suffer as they died up close, eye to eye, in his self-appointed role as the final arbiter over their life. But their coldness is best exemplified by Charles Ng, who on videotape sometime in the 1980s can be seen tormenting one of the women he and Leonard Lake killed in a home-built dungeon by telling her, "You can cry and stuff like the rest of them, but it won't do any good. We are pretty, ha-ha, cold-hearted, so to speak." Many urges, few controls, no reflection. While these personalities like to control others, they themselves have no moral or ethical controls and can also be impulsive, adventure-seeking risk-takers. Clyde Chestnut Barrow, of Bonnie and Clyde fame, was just like that, a reckless thrill-seeker who became a bank robber and a murderer. Many modern bank robbers and serial shoplifters exhibit that lack of controls, as do street muggers. There's the thrill of the act, coupled with the attractive material reward, the very definition of a good day for a predator. For many predators, acting on urges seems to dominate their lives, even when it means placing themselves or other people in danger. For example, Nashawn Williams was convicted of knowingly and intentionally infecting at least 13 women with the HIV virus. A career criminal also charged with rape, according to the courts, he intentionally jeopardized the lives of others just as surely as if he'd put a gun to their heads and played Russian roulette. Similarly, Anthony E. Whitfield, according to his own attorney, was a methamphetamine-addicted sex machine who bounced between women for shelter, money, and sex. He infected 17 women with the HIV virus before he was caught, with no apology or remorse, seemingly out of control. Much like narcissists, predators may be highly reactive to the slightest provocation or perceived insult. They often lack any kind of inhibition or self-control. In prison, predators will avoid even looking at each other, knowing full well that an aggressive look in the hallway is enough to ignite an altercation or a lethal retribution. As I write this, I'm reminded of Joe Pesci's memorable portrayal of Tommy DeVito in the film Goodfellas. Temperamental, hypersensitive to slights, unforgiving, and with no conscience. Only in the movies, you say? No. There are real people like that. Richard Leonard, the Iceman Kuklinski, had a bad temper and took no prisoners when it came to insults. That's why the mob hired him as a contract killer. He told authorities after his arrest that he lost count of how many he had murdered. There were perhaps as many as 200 victims. He killed first, asked questions later. The real-life actions of predators are often worse than their movie portrayals. In this case, Kuklinski put the fictional Tommy DeVito to shame. Predators frequently abuse alcohol and other illegal substances, which tend to make them more unstable, less inhibited, and more dangerous. Or they use alcohol and drugs to intentionally lower their own inhibitions or to seduce others. I examined numerous cases while in the FBI of stepfathers or even fathers using alcohol or drugs on underage young women, including their own daughters, to rape them. John Wayne Gacy was known to use alcohol to render his victims more pliant, especially just before he raped and sadistically killed them. While predators are often driven by urges or say they couldn't help themselves, there's no excuse for what they do. If they engage in any kind of self-evaluation, it's to perfect their methods of predation. Don't ever expect them to introspectively ponder how to change for the better. They won't. Words that describe the predator. Here are the uncensored words of the victims. Notice how similar some words are to those describing the narcissistic personality. See Chapter 1. Abnormal, abusive, aggressive, aimless, amoral, animal, antisocial, arrogant, articulate, bad, badass, bad boy, barbaric, bastard, beast, beguiling, belittling, belligerent, bewildering, biker, black widow, boorish, bullshitter, bully, calculating, callous, charismatic, charming, cheat, cheater, clever, cold, cold-blooded, con artist, con man, conniving, contemptuous, controlling, corrupt, corrupting, creep, creepy, criminal, crude, cruel, cunning, dangerous, deceitful, deceptive, degenerate, delinquent, demeaning, depraved, deranged, destructive, devilish, dick, discomforting, discordant, disgusting, dishonest, disingenuous, disruptive, domineering, egocentric, electrifying, empty, evil, exploitive, fire-setter, forger, fraud, gangster, gigolo, glib, godless, grandiose, grifter, guiltless, hasty, heartless, hellish, horrible, hostile, hustler, immoral, impostor, impulsive, incompatible, inconsiderate, incorrigible, indecent, indifferent, infidelity, inhuman, inhumane, insane, insatiable, insensitive, insincerity, intense, interesting, intimidating, irresponsible, irritable, irritating, killer, kleptomaniac, larcenous, lawbreaker, lecherous, leech, liar, loveless, Machiavellian, malevolent, manipulative, mean, mercurial, mesmerizing, mobster, monster, moody, mortifying, narcissistic, nomadic, notorious, noxious, nuisance, odd, parasite, parasitic, pedophile, perverted, picky, pimp, player, possessive, predator, predatory, prick, prickly, promiscuous, puppeteer, quick, rapist, risk-taker, robber, rubbish, rude, ruinous, sadist, sadistic, sarcastic, savage, scary, seducer, seductive, seductress, self-centered, selfish, shallow, shifty, shit, sleazy, smooth, superficial, swindler, tactless, temperamental, thief, thrill-seeker, thug, toxic, twisted, two-faced, tyrant, uncaring, undependable, unfeeling, unfettered, uninvolved, unreliable, unscrupulous, unsympathetic, untrustworthy, vandal, vile, vindictive, violent, volatile, vulgar, wicked, wild, witty. Their effect on you. Expect predators to turn your life upside down and derail your dreams or aspirations, as they come first and don't like people to get in their way. You may initially find them intelligent, charming, and interesting, but when you discover what they've done, or when they turn on you, which can happen at any moment, the shock and pain are indescribable. They'll exhaust you because you must always be on guard, hiding what you treasure, trying to not antagonize or struggling to survive. They can torment you or easily wear you down. It's their choice. Remember Julian's father? Eleanor, a very nice woman I used to occasionally see at criminal profiling conferences, had been on guard against her son for years. To no avail. The last time I heard from her, she told me that her live-in, 40-year-old, good-for-nothing son had taken all of her money. She was worn down from trying, as she said, to always be one step ahead of that boy. Her son, the predator she'd harbored and sustained out of the goodness of her heart, had bankrupted her. At 60, this nearly retired nurse had to take on two jobs to meet her financial obligations, and she no longer has any faith or affection for her son. Some predators will get family and friends to co-sign a loan or invest in something that has no future or prospects. They simply don't care what hardships they cause or what money you may lose, so long as it's not theirs. Ask a bail bondsman how many cases they know of where one of these career criminals has skipped on a bond and left the family impoverished after getting them to post tens of thousands of dollars in bail, or even the title to their homes. It's staggering. These dangerous personalities think nothing of endangering you through their behavior. They're the kind who'll ask to borrow your car and then use it to rob a bank, or get you to drive them to a friend's house while, unbeknownst to you, they're carrying a backpack full of drugs. Or they'll ask you to lie and cover for them at work to conceal their criminal activities, or even to provide alibis. Suddenly you'll find yourself in trouble with the law because they asked you to do a favor, lie for them, or get involved in a criminal act. expect to feel uneasy at their intrusive looks, questions, or presence. They unnerve us when they become too friendly too quickly and then latch on with too much familiarity. In the movie, the talented Mr. Ripley, Matt Damon, plays the part of a predator who latches onto a victim and won't let go until he gets what he wants. In a similar way, predators place demands on us that we don't really want to fulfill, or they seek intimacy or trespass on our privacy without regard to our wishes or needs. This is no accident. It is intended. With some predators, you may actually feel a physical reaction. You may shake or feel your hairs stand up. As I mentioned, happened to me. The notable researcher and author J. Reed Malloy, Ph.D., found that even trained professionals have a visceral reaction to these predatory individuals. Similarly, in his book, The Gift of Fear, Gavin DeBecker describes how these toxic individuals register with us on a very primitive, limbic level, a subconscious warning system of sorts that we evolved to alert us to danger. Unfortunately, society tells us to turn off that warning system and assume everyone is good and kind. While you're busy trusting the predators, they're busy learning all your exploitable weaknesses, the better to take advantage of you. They'll steal your goodwill, your virtue, or your generosity as their due. That is what predators do. As to reciprocity, they'll deliver it when and where they want, or not at all. In 2013, Michael Chad Boyson's family eagerly awaited his release from incarceration for a burglary he committed. His grandparents readied a bedroom for him, picked him up when he was finally released, drove him to get a new ID card, even took him to his first meeting with his probation officer just to make sure everything went well. Sometime later that day, Boyson killed them. That was their reward for their loving help. When we help, give in to, or go along with these individuals, we enable and embolden them to take further advantage of us or of others. Thinking that they'll change, or that this time will be different, is like expecting a snake to be less of a reptile just because you fed and stroked it. Don't expect goodness from those who can't deliver it. They can deliver kindness when they want to get what they want. Kindness, however, can blind parents into letting their child spend time with the likes of Jerry Sandusky, the serial child molester. Once they're done with you, not only will you feel violated or betrayed, but thanks to their profound treachery, you'll be reluctant to trust others. Post-traumatic stress disorder is often the net effect of victimization by a predator. Knowing that you or a loved one has been used is deeply scarring. I've talked to victims who years later remain unreconciled, traumatized, and untrusting. Some are still in therapy, others had to be medicated. I know parents who've had to seek medical treatment for anxiety because their daughter had run away with or was marrying a known predator. As I've said, predators leave a large debris field of human suffering. The precise type and timing are really up to them. If you become involved with a predator, you're taking a big risk with your safety and that of your loved ones. You may be exposing others to unnecessary danger simply by granting a predator access. Please, don't take that chance. The predator in relationships. There's no equality in a relationship with a predator. These individuals target the trusting and the nurturing, or act as parasites, living off a human host. They expect you to supply all their needs, but don't expect them to land a job or help around the house. They always have an excuse for not getting work. Their brilliance isn't appreciated. The job's beneath them. Lousy boss, terrible hours, and on, they'll drain you till you have nothing more to give or they tire of you. Then they'll move on to another exploitable person or situation. Elizabeth, whom I met while conducting behavioral training, is an accomplished, intelligent professional who had the misfortune to marry a parasitic predator. He looked good, sounded good, was always good for a beer, and was very athletic. But he did nothing. She tried arranging jobs, marriage counseling, career counseling, even handing out his resume. By her account, he spent all day at home looking at porn while she worked. Those 3 years with him cost her nearly $40,000, as she paid for everything. Clothes, jewelry, vacations, golf clubs, moving expenses, computers, cameras, etc. When she finally had had enough and said it was time for him to go, incredibly he demanded part of her retirement savings, even though they'd been married for only 3 years. That's your parasitic predator, always looking for more. The predator in relationships can be lethal. In all her published photos, Lacey Peterson looks happy and effervescent. But in 2002, when she was pregnant and married to Scott Lee Peterson, he was seeing other women behind her back. On Christmas Eve, as the prosecutor proved at trial, Scott Peterson gutted Lacey, killing her and her nearly 8-month-old fetus. As a predator, he had decided it was time for her to go. In 2003, Stacy Ann Kales married Drew Peterson, no relation to Scott Peterson, shortly after he divorced his third wife, Kathleen Savio. A year later, Kathleen Savio would be found dead in an empty bathtub. Her death initially ruled an accident. Stacy was one of the first to defend her husband, Drew, when he came under suspicion for the death of his former wife. Her faith and allegiance were ill-placed because she had married a predator, and for him, life was cheap. 4 years later, Stacy herself disappeared, devastating her own family, who quite logically feared Drew Peterson. As a result of her disappearance and much pressure from both families, the police reinvestigated the death of Kathleen Savio and determined that it had been no accident. Drew Peterson's luck as a predator ran out in 2013 when he was convicted and sentenced to 38 years for the premeditated murder of Kathleen Savio. Sadly, Stacy's body has never been found, leaving a family without closure or justice. That is the stark reality of living with or marrying a predator. In fact, on average, 3 women die every day at the hands of an intimate partner, a predator in their midst. Intimate partner homicides account for 30% of the murders of women and 5% of the murders of men, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. These are sobering statistics, and often there are clues beforehand that we are in the presence of danger. But we have to pay attention and know what we're looking for. Drew Peterson's previous wives reported how abusive and callous he'd been to them, hints, perhaps, of things to come. Miss the cues or act too late, and you and your loved ones may pay a heavy price. The clock is ticking. By this time tomorrow, according to the statistics above, 3 more women will lose their lives. A predator may look good on paper, but he is still a predator. Colette Stephenson married a physician who was a Princeton graduate, U.S. Army officer, and a Green Beret. But when her husband, Jeffrey Robert McDonald, tired of Colette and their kids in 1970, he killed them all and then claimed that drug-crazed hippies had done it. Investigators didn't buy his story, and neither did the jury. The crime scene was staged to look like a home invasion, and his wounds were all superficial. Jeffrey McDonald remains behind bars, still claiming his innocence, always seeking an appeal, cold as ice. When you're in a relationship with a predator, you're poised somewhere between risky behavior, psychological abuse, or possibly losing your life. It is always that precarious. How often have we read of a wife or girlfriend who was so afraid that she either wrote in her journal or told friends and family that if she were to die or disappear, her husband or boyfriend was probably the culprit? They have premonitions because they see the predator's behavior up close. Some predators live a double life. They prey outside the home and the family is kept in the dark. Or if family members have suspicions, they're afraid to ask. Imagine finding out that dad or mom paid for the house where you grew up with stolen money. How do you love a parent who claims to love you, but who has physically, emotionally, or financially hurt others? And if you do, what does that make you? These are just some of the ways these personalities damage their children without laying a finger on them. Don't expect predators to always be there for their children. Do expect them to be absent or distant, to be brutal at times, or to expose their children to ridicule, harm, danger, criminal activity, and the potential of being incarcerated. The worst situation occurs when the predator involves the whole family in criminal activity. Newspapers are full of stories of husbands who use their spouse to commit a crime. Brian David Mitchell and his wife Wanda Barzi abducted Elizabeth Smart in Utah in 2002 and held her for 9 months. J.C. Lee Dugard was abducted at age 11 and held for 18 years in California by convicted sex offender Philip Craig Garrido and his wife Nancy Garrido. Take a deep breath and read J.C.'s book about her ordeal, A Stolen Life, a memoir. But be prepared to cry. It's a story of a remarkable human being's redemption following predation. Predators are notorious for teaching their children to steal, cheat, lie, avoid responsibility, fight, and break social rules. Some of those I've studied or talked to punished their children not for committing crimes, but for getting caught. John Walker, a U.S. Navy communications specialist, spied for the Russians for decades. He not only put his nation at risk by giving away cryptographic secrets, he also got his son, Michael Walker, involved in his crimes. John Walker got life imprisonment for espionage. Michael got 25 years. Similarly, Mafia Don John Gotti did his son, John A. Jr., no favor by introducing him into the life of a mobster. All that did was ensure the federal government would focus its attention on him upon his father's death. That led to his pleading guilty to racketeering, loan sharking, bookmaking, and extortion in 1999, for which he served 6 years in prison. Between 2004, before he had left prison, and 2009, he was the defendant in 4 additional racketeering trials. These ended in mistrials, with all the attendant legal fees and stress. That is not the kind of life most people would want for their kids. Unless, of course, you are a predator. Then it doesn't matter what you bequeath your family. Then there are those who turn on their own family, who abuse their stepchildren and their own children, or who go after their own parents, like brothers Lyle and Eric Menendez, 2 cold-blooded killers who in 1989 executed their parents with shotguns while the latter watched TV at home. Then they went on a shopping and partying extravaganza until they were finally arrested. These killers had the best of everything, school, money, clothes, cars, tennis lessons. But for predators, enough is never good enough. Sometimes the predator is very subtle, first testing to see how family members react. Carla, a Miami native, told me how her second husband almost immediately began to pay too much attention to her 14-year-old daughter after they married. Over time, she noticed that he was having more and more interactions with her daughter, including a lot of tickling and wrestling on the floor. Then there were the hugs and kisses that seemed to last too long. It was when she found out that he'd secretly taken her daughter to Victoria's Secret to buy her underwear that Carla began to sense something was wrong, especially when her daughter said that this had happened before. Carla's gut feeling was confirmed when she found emails he'd sent her daughter from work. They weren't just playful missives. Carla questioned her daughter about what was going on. Her daughter had been reluctant to say anything, not wanting to rock the boat or spoil her mom's happiness. As it turns out, the husband had tried to do more than just hug her. He had reached between her legs while driving and touched her in other ways that were progressively more intimate and vile. Carla confronted her new husband. He, of course, had one explanation after another. He was trying to fit in and be more of a father to his stepdaughter. The touching inside the legs was accidental, or it never happened. Nothing was his fault. He callously brought Carla's daughter into the conversation, asking, "Haven't I been nice to you? Don't I buy you things? Please tell your mom this is all a mistake. What was her daughter, who Carla told me was shaking like a leaf, supposed to say? His conclusion, you see? Everything is fine. With mobile phone in hand, Carla said to him, you have an hour to pack and leave, or I am calling the sheriff's office. She took her daughter outside and told her to wait with a neighbor while family came to get her. He tried to reason with her. She pointed at the clock. Carla told me that by this time the hairs on her neck were standing up and her skin was crawling as she thought about how much time he'd spent alone with her daughter and those messages she'd read. But what was really getting to her were his attempts to bullshit her and make her think it was all in her head, a common tactic of the predator. At that moment she knew she was in the presence of a predator, and it made her angrier because, as she said, he was just trying to con me again into closing my eyes. Stepchildren are often the targets of sexual abuse by an intimate of the parent. I admire Carla, who did the right thing, and quickly, but the cost was still tremendous in time, money, court depositions, divorce proceedings, attorney fees, and more. There were trust issues that caused her nightmares and psychological damage to her daughter, who felt betrayed that her mother had brought a dangerous person into their home. Years later, there were still issues for everyone involved. That's the debris field left by a predator. Fortunately, Carla prevailed. Many women don't. Not all can get away or see the warning signs in time. And in some cases, the victim is too young, helpless, or trusting to escape. All of Mary Beth Tinning's children, 9 in all, died over the years under her care. Unfortunately, the government was only able to prove that she murdered one of them. Diane Downs felt her 3 kids were keeping her from attracting a man who didn't want children. In 1984, she was convicted of shooting her 3 children, killing one. What a horror story that is for those children to have experienced. In 1999, Krista Decker, mother of 3, whom I helped to investigate in Tampa at the request of the Hillsborough County Sheriff, told investigators that her 6-month-old baby boy had been taken from her vehicle while she went to get a shopping cart at a store. During my interview with her, just hours after she alleged her son had been abducted, I told her I was interested in knowing what her children were like. It was startling to see the difference in how she talked about them. She spoke in warm terms about the 2 older children, but there was a certain coldness in her manner as she spoke about her missing son. We, as investigators, were already suspicious of her story, but what gave her away was the fact that even though her baby had been missing for only a few hours, she referred to him in the past tense. He was always a good baby, she told me. Her 2 living kids, she said, are good kids. The coldness of her tone and her use of the past tense was, led us to conclude that the child was already dead and she knew it. And he was. Eventually she admitted that she had suffocated her baby, fathered by someone other than her husband, in a plastic garbage bag because he wouldn't stop crying. Yes, predators are that cold. There is a lesson here for all of us, and it is this. No relationship or family is safe if one of the parties is a predator. Encounters with the predator. Most encounters with predators tend to be transient. We can meet one at a sporting event, at a bar, at work, or at a concert, where someone introduces us. They come and they go. After all, they have agendas that may not include us. Others, however, we encounter because they target us or because of our occupation or situation in life. These are the individuals we especially want to be vigilant of. There are embezzlers, bank robbers, pickpockets, car thieves, and many more. But there's a reason why we have the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, Megan's Law, and Jessica's Law, among others, because there are so many predators out there who prey on minors. Some are in and out of prison. Each time they get out, they strike again. Others operate undetected for decades. Remember the Catholic priest child abuse scandal? We're fortunate to have those laws, and they're helpful. But even with such laws in place, we still have men like Jerry Sandusky prowling for children. Sexual predation will always be a considerable challenge for society. After all, who in England would have imagined Jimmy Savile, famous BBC TV personality and host of a children's show, raping children? But he did, for decades. Yet all such allegations were dismissed because of his status and popularity. It is axiomatic that it is never healthy for children to be near predators, no matter who they are. Women are also often predators' targets. In the 1960s, Albert Henry DeSalvo, known as the Boston Strangler, traveled the city creating opportunities for himself. Women would let him into their homes and apartments on a multitude of pretenses. He represented a model agency, his car had broken down, he needed to make a call, etc. Women encountered him at home, where they felt safe. But as I've mentioned, you'll never be safe with a predator. Sometimes we unwittingly enter the predator's familiar hunting ground, where they can more easily target us. Natalie Holloway went to Aruba on holiday with her high school friends in 2005. Within hours of meeting Joran van der Sloot, she disappeared, and most likely was killed soon thereafter. Her body was never found. On the surface, van der Sloot looked handsome, charming, and fun. Unfortunately, Natalie had little time to discover what a terrible person he really is. 5 years to the day after Natalie's disappearance, van der Sloot robbed and murdered Stephanie Titania Flores Ramirez, whom he met in Peru while playing cards at a casino. Why would he do that, you ask? That is the kind of question the parent of a missing child asks. Unfortunately, and tragically, it is really not about why predators do these things. It is simply that they can. Sometimes all it takes is to live near a predator. The very week I started this chapter, in May 2013, Ariel Castro was arrested in Cleveland for abducting 3 girls and holding them hostage for 10 years, fathering at least 1 child with one of them. Unfortunately, the girls had been unlucky enough to live in the same neighborhood as this vile predator, who later hanged himself in his jail cell rather than face trial. Castro defeated justice by committing suicide before his trial. Then there are industry-specific predators who tailor their predation to where they're working or what they're doing. Charles Cullen, for instance, was a night shift nurse who admitted killing at least 40 patients, though there may have been many more. He did his worst at work and nowhere else. In the 1980s, Clyde Lee Conrad, too, tailored his activities to his environment. As a U.S. Army sergeant stationed in Germany, he pilfered military supplies when he could, sold gasoline and cigarette ration booklets on the black market, and when that wasn't enough, he stole military secrets and sold them to Soviet Warsaw Pact countries. He put tens of thousands of soldiers and millions of citizens at risk in Europe with his betrayal, all for money. Some predators are pillars of the community, veterans, churchgoers, volunteers, scout leaders, coaches, public officials. Rita Crundwell was the comptroller of Dixon, Illinois, and a renowned American quarter horse breeding enthusiast. She also embezzled $53 million over a 22-year career. The BTK killer, Dennis Rader, was a church leader and a reliable city employee who used his knowledge of the city and the mobility his job afforded him to target his victims. Then there are the corporate predators, who can be found in large institutions as well as in two-person operations. Some say that today's business climate, particularly the high-stakes cutthroat world of finance, attracts and rewards predatory behavior. These individuals may be charismatic and interesting, but they can also place a company at risk through their impulsive, aggressive behavior. That's exactly what Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling are famous for having done at Enron. They were charged with fraud, and Enron's 2001 bankruptcy was the biggest corporate bankruptcy of its time, where many people lost their livelihood as well as their life savings. The Enron case is a reminder that predation often takes place at the highest levels of the corporate world if unethical individuals are in charge. The financial meltdown of 2008 was in part created by predators within the financial industry who created risky lending practices and then hedged against those ventures, knowing they were highly unstable, if not toxic. Aggressiveness and toughness in business are one thing, but criminal acts and intentional fraud are quite another. Businesses are learning that having a predator on the books is hazardous to the organization, investors, and employees. They can do risky things, or they can be disruptive, destabilizing, or dangerous to the business. While working with a predator is bad enough, living under the thumb of one when they lead a government can be horrific. Just ask anyone who experienced the torment of Adolf Hitler, Pol Pot, or Joseph Stalin. The alleged butcher of Bosnia, Radovan Karadzic, was, according to the victims, no better. Neither was Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, who used torture and poisonous gas weaponry on his own Kurdish minority. As I write this chapter, we're reading and hearing about Syria, where Bashar Hafez al-Assad, no friend of human rights, has turned his military loose on his own countrymen, using poisoned gas, causing millions to flee and tens of thousands of casualties. Predators as leaders have one mission, staying in power by any means. To them, suffering and deaths are insignificant. The saying often attributed to Joseph Stalin summarized best how predators view mass killings. Kill one person and it's a national tragedy. Kill a million people, it is a statistic. Yes, they are that cold. I hope this chapter has demonstrated that encounters with a predator are always dangerous. Sometimes we encounter them because we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or they're our boss, or the person at the desk next to ours. Nevertheless, we can still work at being safe by knowing how these individuals act. We can look for behaviors to see if this person is toxic, is recklessly irresponsible, thinks only of him or herself, is dangerously intrusive, or is a mortal threat. That is our responsibility to ourselves and our loved ones. Your Dangerous Personalities Checklist. Warning Signs of the Predator. As I noted in the introduction, I developed various behavior-based checklists during my career to help me assess individuals to see if they were dangerous personalities. This particular checklist will help you determine if someone has the features of the predator and where that person falls on a continuum or spectrum. From calculating and opportunistic to cold and callous, or at the extreme, lacking conscience and utterly dangerous. This will help you decide more precisely how to deal with this person, determine his or her toxicity, and assess whether he or she may be a threat to you or others. This checklist, as well as the others in this book, was designed to be used in everyday life by you and me. People who are not trained mental health professionals or researchers. It is not a clinical diagnostic tool. Its purpose is to educate, inform, or validate what you have witnessed or experienced. Listen to each statement in the checklist carefully and check the statements that apply. Be honest. Think about what you have heard an individual say or seen him or her do, or what others have expressed to you. Obviously, the best evidence is what you yourself have observed and how you feel when you are around or interact with this person. Check only the statements that apply. Don't guess or include more than meet the criteria exactly. If in doubt, leave it out. Some items seem repetitive or appear to overlap. That is intentional, to capture nuances of behavior based on how people typically experience or describe these personalities. It is very important that you complete the entire checklist as designed to increase its reliability. Each complete checklist covers very subtle yet significant issues that you may never have thought about. Some items may help you remember events you'd forgotten. Please listen to each statement, even if you feel you've heard enough or that the first few items don't seem to apply. Gender pronouns, he, she, etc., are used interchangeably in the statements. Any statement may be applicable to any gender. We'll evaluate scores when you're done, but for now, check off each item below that applies. Number 1. Disregards the rights of others by abusing them or taking advantage of them. 2. Is manipulative and all too often gets people to do things for him. 3. Was arrested and adjudicated.